This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Though a ceasefire between Israelis and Palestinians is still in place, the decades-old conflict continues to erupt online. From hashtags praising Hitler to Facebook groups promising revenge on Hamas, social media is a hotbed of partisan vitriol. Could those hateful messages taking place far from Gaza be stoking Israeli-Palestinian tensions? Emily Shire is a reporter for The Daily Beast, and she examines this question in her article, Trolling the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Emily Shire, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with some examples of what kind of things are being said online and how widespread and how extreme.
Sure. Well, it really was widespread. That's what was disturbing to me when I began to investigate it, particularly when it came to bringing out levels of anti-Semitism, which definitely complicated things because, you know, the tie between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and kind of bringing up, often boiling down, anti-Semitic views in parts of the world is pretty strong. So, you know, Hitler was right. Hitler did nothing wrong were things that began to trend on Twitter and sometimes those regular civilians. But a lot of those pro-Hitler messages actually made it to higher levels of government in South Africa. A woman who worked for the African National Congress wasn't even suspended from her job when she posted a pro-Hitler, pro-Holocaust message on her Facebook. Mm. So it definitely was disturbing to see, I think to a certain degree, high government officials almost didn't take it that seriously because it is, it's Twitter, it's Facebook, it's, you know, these forms of social media we use really for recreational purposes. But it became widespread through these platforms.
You call it a parallel battleground taking place online. Right now, a ceasefire is holding. Is that reflected in social media?
I think it's reflected in that you don't see quite the same level of insightful messages. But that may also be more of a reflection in that a ceasefire is holding. This isn't in the news quite as much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that's probably what it's more of a bigger marker of. If people aren't discussing it, you know, on TV and other forms, then it's probably not going to be reflected quite as much in these social media platforms. But I will say the types of debate that you see on CNN and other, you know, cable news networks and, you know, in newspapers and different op-ed columns is very much at a different, much more mature and restrained level than what you see then explode online.
So you mentioned regular citizens, even some higher level government members in different places. How do we know who's posting these Hitler hashtags and, you know, the anti-Arab Facebook groups? Are they centered in the region, for starters?
On Facebook, we can know in that if you click on it, you can see, you know, where do they list as their location and assume that they're not lying. I can say this from the research I've done, it's from all over. It can be people in the United States. It could, you know, this was an example of someone in South Africa, people in the Middle East, people throughout Europe. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is an issue that globally many people, probably anyone remotely informed on the news, has an opinion on. It doesn't just affect the Middle East and it doesn't just affect the U.S. And anyone with an opinion on it is joining these groups.
Hmm. Well, you could even look at the hashtag ISIL or ISIS and not find such toxic exchanges. Why does the Israeli-Palestinian conflict spark such an emotional response and widespread across the globe?
I think because it's been lasting for so long and it's laden in so many heavy emotions. I think with ISIS, although, you know, we as Americans are debating how do we proceed, you know, strategically, we can all agree on the fact that they're a group, that's a terrorist organization that's doing horrible things. And those differences in, you know, how to move forward in our attack against them seem minimal compared to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that really draws strong emotions on both sides. And there's a lot of debate on how each side is painted. And that's been going on for decades. And it also goes back to a history of anti-Semitism, which is going on even longer, which complicates things. And it's just a lot of emotions to be dealing with. And there are a lot of emotions that then get boiled down into 140-character tweets.
Well, that's a question. You know, these messages get super focused, and people, of course, can remain anonymous. That's the nature of trolling. They can hide behind a handle. Do you have any sense of whether these posts reflect people's true sentiments or even numbers?
I don't think there's a way to fully tell that, you know, in terms of polling, because, look, if we polled you know, Americans and how they felt about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict wouldn't at all, you know, be on Twitter or on Facebook or using social media. I think the fact that you see this level of vitriol and it's not getting necessarily a strong response is that we've gotten used to these kind of comments. That's the scarier point to me, that this is changing the tenor of the debate. And so, you know, it's not insignificant numbers. These are not, you know, when something begins starting to trend on Twitter, it's something you should start paying attention to. It's no longer, you know, a fringe minority thought. But that being said, even if it's not, you know, a huge portion, like 50% of all people on Twitter, the fact that we're kind of getting immune to these styles of comments is what's more disturbing to me.
Well, does this kind of hate speak on Twitter have any real-world consequences?
Oh, I absolutely think it does. I think it's this idea if you see something you've posted enough time on Facebook or you see a tweet enough time on Twitter, you get used to thinking that this is a normal thing. These hashtags, you know, Hitler was right, or you know, revenge groups on Facebook, these aren't normal ways for us to be having a debate. It escalates it to such an extreme, and yet we're getting used to these very extremist views. You know, we see it more and more, and it kind of soaks into the system, and it changes how we look at things.
Is there any debate really going on, any interaction between pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli groups, or is it just an echo chamber, you know, people looking for their own biases and confirming them?
I don't think there are good debates. I mean, I think you can go to these Facebook groups and see, you know, if someone posts something inflammatory, a lot of people will write comments back in response. So, yeah, that's debate to a certain degree, but I think it's very hard to change people's views without having an in-person discussion. And I think already, if you're trying to argue against a very inflammatory view and that person stands by an inflammatory view, they're already in a state of mind where they're not necessarily open to debate and changing their thoughts.
Emily, in your article, you pick up on the role that Twitter played as instrumental in at least ushering or organizing the Arab Spring, you know, giving a voice to all sorts of people, letting them know where to gather. So what happened? Has Twitter lost that potential?
I think the frustrating thing is that Twitter had this great power to unite, and I don't think necessarily that power to unite the masses and to spread views in that regard is so necessarily different in its ability to spread views with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. With the Arab Spring, it was obviously, you know, for this certain kind of good and a sense of freedom that these people weren't alone in craving it, and it gave them, I think, a certain courage and power to unite. But at the same time, what we saw with that is it wasn't enough to sustain a movement, that it, you know, getting people excited about something isn't necessarily going to fuel all the logistics on the ground. And at the same time, a lot of these leaders in Arab countries began to see how powerful social media was. And then it's tough because when you see these new leaders come into power, they know how effective these forms of social media were. And at the end of the day, it's very tough to combat if they're going to shut it down.
Emily Shire, reporter for The Daily Beast, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You'll find a link to read Emily's article, Trolling the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. You may have heard that Amazon recently bought the online video platform Twitch for nearly $1 billion. So what the heck is Twitch? Up next, we're going to find out why Amazon dished out big bucks for a service that streams other people playing video games. That's after a quick break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Maybe you heard late last month about Amazon buying the online platform Twitch for $970 million. Well, if you're anything like me, your first thought was, what the heck is Twitch? Now I know that Twitch is a streaming service where more than 50 million unique visitors go every month to watch other people play video games. So like YouTube, there are thousands of channels where users can live stream hundreds of games. You can also hear and see the player through the use of webcams and microphones. To get a sense of what this sounds like, here's a clip of the user named Sevatus playing the game Minecraft. And you should know that when we recorded this clip, there were more than 3,000 people watching him play.
Okay. Enough. Seriously, enough. Enough. Okay? Enough. Stop it. Enough. I need 5 bags or something for my next bag quest, I believe. I think it's 5 bags.
Now, for the uninitiated, the appeal of watching someone else play a video game is difficult to explain. So we asked Kyle Orland, senior gaming editor at Ars Technica, to help us better understand. He recently wrote the article, A Newbie's Guide to Why So Many People Are Watching Twitch. Kyle, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess the first thing that most of us non-gamers might ask is, why watch someone else play a game instead of just playing it?
Sure, I get that question a lot from people who aren't gamers, and I guess my response would be, why do people watch the NFL when you can go out and play football yourself? It's not really the same experience. They're kind of complementary. Watching the best people or the most entertaining people play something can be even more entertaining than actively participating in that game as a relative novice.
Whatever the appeal, it is a huge website. Give us a sense of the scale. How many people watch Twitch?
Yeah, like you said, it was over 50 million unique visitors in July. I think they said there were 1 million unique streamers in that month, which includes a lot of people who are on the new PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. Those systems came out with a Twitch integration that makes it really easy to share whatever game you're playing with the world. Even if you only get, you know, 5 or 6 viewers, just random people who are bored, they can type comments to you as you play, and you can speak to them through a microphone to respond to them. It kind of makes things a little less lonely if you're just going through, you know, a single-player game. It feels like you have an audience, that it matters a little bit more than to just your living room.
And you point out that the site is responsible for roughly 2% of peak U.S. internet traffic, beating out Hulu and Facebook even. You said anybody could play and others can watch them, but are those that draw the traffic Twitch professionals? You know, are there players with a variety of skill levels, and does that even matter to a viewer?
Oh, sure. It matters quite a bit, I'd say. The most popular streamers are really pro level at these games, and the most popular games are the ones that have huge esports competitions. Things like League of Legends, the finals for that drew 32 million total viewers and 8.5 million viewers at any one time at its peak. So that's comparable to the NBA finals of video gaming. The interesting thing that makes it a little different than sports analogies is that you can watch these people as they're training, really. When they, you know, hop on to do some practice during the day, they'll turn on Twitch, and thousands of people will just watch them basically practicing, listening to them give their strategies and getting an insider's view of how these people train.
Commentary also is part of the draw. Now, you admit, Kyle, to having your own Twitch addiction, and especially like to watch a guy who's called Trump, play a game called Hearthstone. Let's hear just a little bit from Trump's channel.
So on this turn, 2-7-8-10 is the plan. But might change if I draw something good.
I hope you like my invention.
Well played.
Oh.
So very specific narration there from Trump. I know nothing about the game, but what is it about Trump that you particularly like to watch?
Yeah, well, first off, he's one of the best players in the world. He often takes part in tournaments, wins tens of thousands of dollars just for playing this silly card game. But like you could hear in that clip, he really takes you through every decision he makes in this game. This isn't a fast-paced game. It's a card game where you have plenty of time for your turns, and even very little modifications in your strategy can have big effects. So you'll hear him saying, oh, should I play this card or this card, or maybe he'll do this next turn. I'm not going to do this because later on he's going to do this. And by taking you through the strategy at that level, it's much better than, you know, just reading a dry tutorial on how to play better. Mm-hmm. And you kind of get a rooting interest for him, too. You want to see him do well, just kind of vicariously, even when you don't have a chance to play the game, when you maybe are, you know, watching your newborn, in my case, or distracted by other things, you can pause a video where you can't quite as easily pause the game.
And I should just point out that Hearthstone is a digital card game, right?
Yes, it's a free-to-play game, actually. I've played for hundreds of hours without spending a cent on the cards, which is been a great value for me.
It's funny, you point out that Trump, he's a thoughtful guy, a pensive kind of contemplative person.
Yeah.
But listening to him, he doesn't sound like that kind of, you know, out-of-the-box social media celebrity that we are used to hearing about. Yet he's branded like one on Twitch. How does he make money on this site? $10,000, you said.
Yeah, he makes thousands of dollars. People can subscribe to your channel at $5 a month, I think, and often that's the only way they can participate in the comment threads that go alongside the videos, which are these stream of consciousness fests that let you interact with the most popular people on the service. Some of them also have sponsorships through YouTube. You can put your archived videos on there. When ads are run through there, you make more money. There's for the biggest names, there are obviously other ways through sponsorships or tournaments. People want to associate with your name as a brand, pretty much, and make money that way. Now, you know, the average person who has 100 viewers at most is not going to be able to quit his job making the games. But at the top, there is a lot of money to be made there.
Mm. We're talking with Carl Orland. He's senior gaming editor at Ars Technica about Twitch. That is the platform that Amazon paid $970 million for. It's basically a place where you can watch other people play video games. Kyle, it seems like there's a pretty high barrier to entry for some of these games. You know, the NFL has made watching football pretty easy, even for the casual fan, right? Highlighting the first down markers, using instant replay. Is there anything like that in the works for watching professional esports?
Yeah, it depends on the game. Some people are trying to work on it. One of the most popular games, Dota 2, you pretty much have no idea what's going on if you've never played the game. And even if you have played a little bit, it can be hard to follow the high-level tactics. But in a recent tournament, they rolled out a specific newcomer stream which had casters or commentators that were specifically focused on telling people how the game works and explaining strategies in in-depth detail that, you know, higher-level players might not find as interesting. It's still not easy to get into, but it's a little bit easier than just being thrown into it.
So many different types of video games out there. Are there some titles or genres that are more popular to watch on Twitch than others?
Yeah, like I said, the esports games are the most popular, but even outside of those, games like Minecraft, you know, games where people can express their creativity, I would say, are the easiest ones to get into. A game like Minecraft, you can build whatever you want, create whole worlds out of these little blocks, and watching master artisans do that is kind of as addictive as, you know, watching someone at Legoland build a scale model of the Statue of Liberty, except they're talking to you as they do it, and you're able to talk to them and all the other people watching as kind of a communal experience.
I feel like I'm understanding this better and better, but I'm wondering about Amazon's decision to spend $970 million on this. Where's the revenue for them?
It sounds like a lot, but, you know, so go back to 2005 when Google spent billions of dollars on YouTube. Back then, it seemed like a lot for a site that was not nearly the YouTube it is today. Now, YouTube is where everyone goes for web videos. Twitch has kind of found a way into the market that YouTube really hadn't exploited. They have live streaming videos, but they're not nearly as popular brand-wise as Twitch's have been. If this is going to become, you know, the ESPN of video games and have even further growth, $970 million might end up being a steal.
Kyle Orland, senior gaming editor at Ars Technica, thank you very much for the primer on Twitch.
Thank you.
You can find a link to read Kyle's article, A Newbie's Guide to Why So Many People Are Watching Twitch. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. Like Twitch, Alibaba commands a huge amount of global market share, yet many people have never heard of it. Not until last spring, anyway, when the e-commerce giant announced plans to go public. After months of anticipation, Alibaba's initial public offering is happening later this month and is on track to be the largest IPO ever. So if you're still wondering exactly what Alibaba is, Rob Fleischman joined us in July for a primer. Here are a few helpful highlights from that conversation.
These folks, you know, basically control online commerce in China. They have over 80% of the online commerce in China. And that's huge because there are a billion people in China
Mm-hmm. So what can you buy on Alibaba?
Oh, I mean, almost anything manufactured in China at giant quantities, from bicycles to rubber bands to automotive parts. I mean, you name it. Anything manufactured is available there. But Alibaba really is a holding company of a lot of other companies. The largest, most well-known is Taobao, which is the equivalent of our eBay. It's a customer-to-customer, consumer-to-consumer site, much like eBay, except they host about 1 billion products. 60% of the parcels delivered in China are sourced from Alibaba.
Wow.
They did $120 billion in sales in 2012, $250 billion in 2013.
Now, how does that stack up to something like an Amazon?
Oh, it's the sum of Amazon and eBay. I mean, their valuation, conservatively, what Wall Street's saying is that when Alibaba goes public, there will only be three tech companies in the world larger than them, and that'll be Apple, Google, and Microsoft in terms of market cap.
Rob Fleischman is CTO at Zero Coal and chief explainer of all things Wired here on Word of Mouth. He gave us a primer on Alibaba back in July. If you'd like to hear the entire explanation, you'll find the full interview on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, an examination of numbers and nature. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to head to the Arctic Sea with the Indiana Jones of mathematics. That's after the news from NHPR. Ken Golden isn't your typical mathematician. He's kind of an Indiana Jones of mathematics. Ken gets up from behind his desk, armed with mathematical theory, and goes boldly out into the world, having adventures and finding unifying math behind seemingly unconnected subjects. Today, we find him on the Arctic sea ice, drawing on math developed for stealth technology to understand not only the ice, but the bones of people with osteoporosis.
100 miles from land, ice and snow extend in every direction, a landscape of intense white. Except for a dot of bright blue, that's Ken Golden's jacket.
Right now we're on part of the Arctic Ocean. We're standing on first-year sea ice that's about 1 meter thick.
Ken wields a drill half his height. He's standing over it like he would a jackhammer. And he's drilling down through the ice.
You can feel some soft layers up near the surface. It's a very beautiful and unique setting to be in here, especially for a math professor.
You see, Ken's a little different than most people who work in the Arctic. He's a mathematician. In fact, he's even been called the Indiana Jones of mathematics. Yeah. That's Ken. Clearly he digs the reference.
Doing mathematics, but going off to these crazy, far-flung places throughout the world and getting in all kinds of dangerous situations.
Working out on thin sea ice, getting stuck on the wrong side of giant fractures. Once he was on board a burning ship.
A burning ship in Antarctica, my first time there.
But Ken's not doing these things just to brag. He uses these adventures to solve mysteries. Along the way, he makes connections between things you'd never think about linking up. Which brings us back to the ice that Ken's drilling into.
Perfect. Perfect. Just what we wanted.
Ken pulls a thin cylinder of ice out of the hole he's drilled. He puts his eye right up to it. He's looking inside the ice. It's not like a clear column of glass. It's riddled with tiny channels that make it look milky white.
That's the unique thing about sea ice that many people don't realize. They say, oh, it's frozen water. It's just a solid piece of ice. But of course, in fact, it's very different from the ice cubes in a drink. That's pure water that's been frozen. Basically, it's a solid. But when seawater freezes, the salt sort of interferes.
The water molecules can't freeze with all that salt in the way. So the salt gets pushed to one side. What you end up with are these tiny channels of super salty water that run throughout the ice. And it's these channels that make sea ice different from the ice that comes out of your freezer. This ice is permeable. That means water can flow through it.
Yeah, sea ice is just an amazing substance. From extremely permeable all the way down to just almost like a granite.
Now, being able to predict when water can flow through ice isn't just something that's interesting to an obscure group of Arctic scientists. It matters. It dictates how sea ice freezes, how quickly ice can melt, how strong that ice is. Real things that help climate scientists understand how our planet is changing and how fast. But until Ken came along on one of his adventures in 1994, No one knew what conditions allowed water to flow through ice.
And one fateful night, it was in the middle of a raging storm. Winds were blowing probably 40, 50 knots, and I was out on the sea ice. All of a sudden, I see seawater flooding up on the surface and flooding the snow layer.
Right before his eyes, he was watching the sea ice switching from an impermeable granite to a permeable, leaky solid.
And literally, in that instant, sort of all these bells went off in my head.
Math bells. He knew immediately what math to use to understand what was happening. It's called percolation theory.
So percolation theory, I like to call the theory of connectedness.
It goes like this. Think of the ice as a maze full of channels. Some that connect, others that dead end, all spread out through the ice. And the question is, how do you know when water can make it through that maze?
You might think, well, gee, to predict something so complicated, you might need a very detailed theory that incorporates all the gory details of sea ice microstructure. But that's not true.
Ken's theory is simple. Forget about solving the maze, charting all the twists and turns. Forget knowing exactly how the channels are connected. Ken says all you have to know is how many channels there are. If there are enough channels, they'll connect. According to the math, they have to. And you get more channels the warmer the ice is.
Coldest, a bunch of individual inclusions.
Very few water channels, all unconnected, nothing flows.
A little bit warmer, they start to grow.
Maybe a few channels start to join up.
Even warmer, they start to connect up with each other.
Larger groups of channels form.
And then finally, at a much higher temperature, it's like a continuous filament.
All of a sudden, continuous routes open up through the maze. You simply use the temperature to predict how many channels there are, and percolation theory will tell you if water can find a way through. The math doesn't even care about where exactly the water flows, just that it can, somewhere. Ken's intuition for using this math came from an unlikely place.
The answer was provided by realizing that the microstructure of sea ice is strikingly similar to the microstructure of radar-absorbing stealthy materials. Stealth technology, what they coat these aircraft with.
This might sound like quite a leap, but go with him for a second. The material that makes an aircraft invisible absorbs radar waves by turning them into electricity. This electricity then escapes through the material in tiny, complicated channels. Sound familiar?
I finally realized, hey, I think this is like sea ice.
Being a mathematician, Ken knew it didn't matter what the substance was, or even what was flowing through it, only that the principle is the same. All Ken had to do was borrow the stealth shielding math, make a couple of adjustments, and he could predict at which temperature ice becomes permeable. And just last year, he took this one step further. He realized that the same math that explains sea ice can explain what's happening in the bones of people with osteoporosis.
With osteoporosis, what's the problem? I mean, you've got a matrix of solid bone, and then what's filled into the holes is more fluid, you know, blood and fluid. And anyway, I'm not an expert on bone.
But turns out he doesn't have to be.
From a mathematical standpoint, it's an almost identical problem.
And so Ken used the ice math to develop a new method for imaging bones. This kind of thing is what he's all about, seeing math connections between subjects he often knows nothing about. But to make these connections, he has to get out from behind his desk, out into the world.
So to speak, getting your hands dirty, or frozen, as the case may be.
And while the Indiana Jones thing may be a little bit of a stretch,
I think it's good for mathematics. That's why I've allowed it to kind of propagate and to persist, because I think the general public has a certain view of mathematicians. Head in the clouds, they don't do anything that is applicable to reality and so on. But of course, mathematics is very applicable to reality.
For this Indiana Jones, math is the key not just for unlocking the mysteries of the world, but figuring out how to connect them over and over again. From the Arctic sea ice, I'm Ben Harden.
And that story came to us as part of PRX's STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Up next, love neuroses and germophobia turned on its head. We'll step into the complicated chaos of dog parks with a reluctant dog owner.
I have to admit, my editor at one point said to me at St. Martin's Press, he said, "Do we really have to talk so much about poop?" And I said, "Yes, we do, because it's a topic at the dog park."
We'll pick up that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Yeah. Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Matthew Gilbert was not a dog person. Far from it. Nor was he much of a sporty or outdoorsy type. As television critic for the Boston Globe, he spent much of his time watching the tube, writing, tweeting, and observing the mediated universe online. His digital bubble was punctured by love. And with that love came Toby. Eventually, a rambunctious yellow lab. Then the dog park, where the playful chaos of doggy life collides with the boundaries and distance of civilized society. Day by day, Matthew's inhibitions and reserve eroded, and he became one of the very people he once thought of as a pack of freaks. Matthew Gilbert tells that story in a new book called Off the Leash, A Year in the Dog Park. And Matthew Gilbert, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Tell us about your first visit to the Amory Street Dog Park in Brookline, Massachusetts. Now, you described this in the book as the Purell incident.
Yeah, I mean, I was overthinking the whole germ issue. as a first-time dog owner, I thought, you know, these bags that I'm using to pick up the dog poop, are they permeable on some very, very, very microscopic level? You know, are little tiny germs getting into my fingerprints? And, you know, am I going to be, you know, poisoned to death? Or you're going to die from some infection? So, you know, I used to carry around Purell. And every time I picked up a poop, I would dump the poop in the basket, or the barrel at the park or on the sidewalk, and then I would use my Purell. And people started laughing at me. It was a little absurd. And of course, now, 10 years later, I realize how bonkers that was.
Well, it's just so funny, the image of you and others, you know, with their bags of steaming dog poop, talking about big philosophical issues. But you meet and begin to know a number of these people that we do want to hear about. But you don't at first know their names or what they do. You're introduced through your dogs. Now, that is liberating for you, but it's also kind of frightening. Why was it frightening?
Well, you know, I think there's a whole different hierarchy at the dog park. You know, it's its own little subculture, and you may be, you know, a wealthy person or a famous person, and when you walk into the dog park, that kind of doesn't matter. It's really more about whether you're a responsible dog owner, how much you love dogs, whether you can engage with people and have conversations and mix well, whether or not you pick up your dog poop, because, of course, there are a number of villains out there who try not to do that. So it's a whole different world. And it threw me off a little bit. What I've learned to love about it is that very thing. It's this great mixture of intimacy and anonymity, because on the one hand, you're seeing these people once, sometimes twice a day. And, you know, I've had conversations with people about life, death, grief, parenting. But at the same time, there's an anonymity because you often don't even know their last names or where they live or what their family looks like. So it's almost like group therapy in that way. You know, it's sort of this contained social world.
Well, that doesn't mean there are no protocols for dog park behavior. And you mentioned one of them being flouted. Kai, who is pretty much always stoned, even first thing in the morning, kind of a hippie dude, flouts the rule to pick up one's dog poop. In fact, there's a lot of talk about dog poop in this book.
So, I have to admit, my editor at one point said to me at St. Martin's Press, he said, "Do we really have to talk so much about poop?" And I said, "Yes, we do, because it's a topic at the dog park."
Well, then all these animal behaviors, fighting and, of course, how shall I put it, responding to the procreation instinct?
Humping.
Okay, humping. What do these animal behaviors reveal in the dog owners? And one I'm thinking of just comes to mind from the book is Charlotte, her dog Sugar, pretty aggressive whippet. She pretty much clears the park when she arrives.
So what do you see in her behavior and your dog's behavior that kind of make this, erase these lines?
Yeah. It's fascinating to me the way that the relationship between a dog and his or her owner is a lovely thing, but it's also, there can be a challenge in there. I mean, for me, the challenge was that Toby wanted to play and needed to play and he needed to be social. And he pulled me into that world. And I needed to be pulled into that world. For Charlotte, I think her aggressive dogs, and she actually had two dogs, both of whom were aggressive and egged each other on, those dogs were challenging her to take ownership of them. You know, they were saying to her in some way, help us, control us, put us on leash until we're ready to be let go, you know, scrutinize us to make sure that there are no triggers around that are going to make us feel, you know, anxious. And she did not answer that challenge. She allowed her dogs to attack other dogs too many times. And she wasn't willing to work with the other people at the park to kind of, you know, stop that situation. And unfortunately, ultimately, she was, well, I hate to use the word shunned because it sounds so primitive, but she kind of was shunned.
You can say that. We have the town square here, and there's a little stockade of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel as though my book really is a celebration of the dog park community and the ways that they can be there for each other. But there are a few villains in the book, and Charlotte certainly is one of them. Anyone who exposes other dogs to danger is a bad guy.
Villains and kind of tragic characters. I see Saul. I mean, there's something lovely about him. He doesn't actually have a dog. He just comes out for the camaraderie.
Yes. One of the sweet and I think unique things about the dog park is that it does attract people from all different walks of life and all different age groups. So I find myself mingling with people who are in their 80s, like Saul, and then people who are, you know, in their early 20s and studying at Boston University or some local college. And that really is fun. But yes, there was something really poignant about Saul. He would wander in a loop around the park, and we could see that he was losing his memory. He would ask us the same questions every time he stopped to chat. But such a sweet man and such a smile on him. It was hard when we discovered that he could no longer come to the park because he could no longer drive.
Dogs, especially in park scenarios, remind us that we also have naked desires underneath our defenses and our protective layers, that we too are creatures who live in packs and need to play. That's a quote from Matthew Gilbert's new book, Off the Leash. We're talking with him about the subculture, the cross-section of humanity that shows up at a local dog park. Now, Matthew, you're also kind of sniffing people out. You're doing your little approaches and eventually runs. When did that shift from you, from feeling like you were trapped with these castaways on Gilligan's Island to feeling more like you're running in the middle of the herd?
Yeah, I think that happened across my first year at the park. But one of the pivotal moments was when Toby was attacked by one of Charlotte's dogs. And the other people at the park kind of gathered around me. They rushed over and they made sure the dogs were separated. They scrutinized Toby to make sure that he was okay and that there were no injuries. They checked in with me to make sure I was okay. And they also tried to establish with Charlotte what exactly had happened. They were already tired of her, but they still felt that they needed to engage her in a sort of post-mortem about what had happened to try to, you know, help her see what she was doing wrong. But that was really when I understood that this was a community of people who I think, try to protect their most vulnerable members. Sometimes that's a rescue dog who needs special attention, and sometimes it's a person who may be lonely or wandering around and looking for friends, like Saul.
There are so many revelations in these daily interactions and intrigues and sometimes avoidances. And you eventually realize that the profoundly unathletic self, that's how you describe yourself as a child, has this need to play. You said earlier that you were sort of off your leash. What does that mean for you?
I think we all need a dog to take us to a place where that we can let the dog off leash and go off leash ourselves. Mm-hmm. But since not everybody wants a dog, I think we all need something. We all need something that, you know, it may be playing guitar, it may be exercising. Whatever it is, it needs to be something that enables you to play, to let go. For me, that was such an important thing to learn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I learned it as a 40-something adult. I mean, if you had told me 20 years ago that I was going to be a dog person, and then that I was going to be hanging out at a dog park getting my jollies, I would have thought you were nuts.
Well, now the book has been optioned by NBC for a sitcom, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, how would you, as a TV critic, want to see it made? Or more importantly, perhaps, who would play you?
Well, I've been told that I look a little bit like Ralph Fiennes.
Oh!
Yes, and I'm, you know what?
I'm willing to accept that.
Yeah, I'm taking it. But somehow I don't think he will want to be doing an NBC sitcom. I think this would be a great ensemble sitcom, you know, sort of The Office at the dog park. A group of kind of misfitty but lovable people with a person in the middle of it all kind of giving wry looks to the camera but still enjoying it all. I hope they move forward with it. You know, the distance between an option and an actual pilot and then an actual series is pretty long. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens.
Well, best of luck with that. And Matthew Gilbert, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure.
Matthew Gilbert, longtime TV critic for the Boston Globe and author of Off the Leash, A Year in the Dog Park. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us a photo of your dog with a short caption of its personality. You can send it to our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or to Twitter at wordofmouth. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. And always a pretty interesting conversation going on Twitter and on Facebook. Case in point, last week we heard about a first concert experience and asked you to share your first concert. Well, for me, it was the Patti Smith Group at the Orpheum. And for you, well, here's what some of you had to say. Kara Ann said, Sean Cassidy! ! Our parents surprised my sister and I and told us we were going to see a pet show at the arena. We didn't know better until people started chanting for Sean. For Jill, it was Sonny and Cher. Abby wrote, Emerson, Lake and Palmer at Madison Square Garden, summer of 1976. I was 14. It was also the first time I ever bought a beer. Bruce weighed in with Boston at Thompson Arena in beautiful Hanover, New Hampshire. Don't recall the year, but they were touring their second album with Sammy Hagar. Both Rick and Sue boast that their first concert was the Moody Blues. And Shane said Alice Cooper, Boston Garden, 1984, Raise Your Fist and Yell Tour. He threw spider babies out into the crowd. Spider bodies with baby doll heads. Rock on. Thanks so much for sharing your first concert memories with us. If you'd like to add yours to the list, visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. What better way to share your rites of passage, embarrassing or triumphant, than word of mouth? I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio. Man.